Governor DeSantis is planning an announcement today in Miami about the coronavirus. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There are two presumptive cases in the state, and the governor has declared a medical state of emergency. Miami officials are also awaiting COVID-19 tests to come back. Also, a closer look at the upcoming primary with the controversies in Palm Beach and Broward counties in 2018 and two new supervisors of elections. What's changed before this upcoming election? And there's a new plan for improving Miami-Dade's bus system. How will routes change? Who will be impacted? What do people think needs to improve? And finally, it was almost 60 years ago when the U.S. and the USSR faced off just south of us. We came dangerously close to war. But we were probably a lot closer to conflict than you might think, and Florida played a critical role. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has declared a public health emergency for the state in response to COVID-19, or novel coronavirus. There are two presumptive cases of the virus in Florida. Now, there are no reported cases of the virus in South Florida, but testing is still underway. Joining me now is WLRN's Danny Rivero. Danny, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, we are expecting Governor DeSantis to make an announcement from Miami at 2 o'clock today pertaining to coronavirus, but he did speak in Tampa earlier today. What's he saying?
Right. And he's giving two statements today and filling us in twice. This is a very fast moving situation. So what we hear in Miami later in the day might change from what happened in Tampa earlier. But basically, it's an update on what was going on. He said that to date, this as of this morning, 23 people in the state have been tested for this novel coronavirus. Of course, two of them have tested positive. They're currently monitoring 184 people. And 795 have been monitored. Now what that means, they're monitoring. That means healthcare professionals are going and doing one-on-one visits with them. They're going to where they live. They're taking their temperatures, and they're just kind of monitoring these people if they exhibit any of the symptoms that might be connected to this strain of coronavirus.
As we mentioned, there are tests that are being done on people. Last week, and there were some changes to this story. Last week, Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez talked about his frustrations with the Centers for Disease Control because everybody's getting testing kits so they can do these tests. But there was an issue with the test at the beginning, which has been fixed.
Yes. Yeah, so many counties all across the state got testing kits and across the country, really. But a lot of them were missing one particular part of it that would actually enable them to get the results. That's mostly
because we had to send our test to Atlanta.
Well, that was a result of us not having the fully working kits in the counties. Now, at this point, the state of Florida actually has active state labs in Miami and in Tampa and in Jacksonville where they're doing testing on site, and they should have the results back within 24 to 48 hours, they estimated in the press conference earlier today. Now, any results that come back positive are what they're calling presumptive positive. It means they're assuming that it's positive, but they are still sending those samples to the Center for Disease Control to get get confirmation that these are indeed positives.
And again, the governor is going to be speaking in Miami. Again, that's expected at 2 o'clock. What did Mayor Jimenez or any other officials say about the fact that this is all happening now? We're in March, and there are a lot of big events coming up in March in Miami.
There are. And as of now, you know, one of the biggest hot ticket items is the Ultra Music Festival. That's coming up March 20th to 22nd. As of now, there's no plans to postpone or cancel or anything that event. The county or the city has not made any plans at all to alter that. The concert, the people who are throwing the concert have said that they are going to be providing a lot more hygiene equipment, like hand sanitizers and whatnot, at the concert itself, so people can keep their hands clean and hopefully offset anything from spreading.
And we also have spring breakers who are coming into town for, you know, throughout the month. We have, not also to mention, we have Florida's primary coming up March 17th. And we're going to be talking about elections here in a minute. But have you heard anything from supervisors of elections about protecting poll workers, but also protecting the voters? And is there going to be anything that changes in the process when people go to vote?
So I will say I did call the Miami-Dade Supervisor of Elections office this morning and just ask them, just is there any contingency plan if poll workers don't want to show up, if people are scared to go to the polls? I mean, they don't have much control over whether people go to the polls. But on the question of about the poll workers themselves, they said they do have kind of backup staff that if people do not want to show up, that they can fill in those gaps. So as of now, the early voting started today in Miami-Dade County and I believe in Palm Beach County. That should not be affected.
I think, was it you? I'm trying to remember, where did I hear the phrase, when South America gets sick, Miami gets a cough?
Yeah, when Latin America sneezes, South Florida gets the cold.
Okay. Well, so you know what? I mean, just saying that, I mean, we now know, or we know that we've heard that there are cases being reported that in Brazil, but also now the Caribbean may also be facing.
The first case was came out as positive in the Dominican Republic.
Okay.
Just over this weekend.
So did county officials say anything about the fact that, look, this is Miami, the ports, the airport, any concerns there, or is there anything changing, you know, about how they're doing business just to protect people?
So we have one of the busiest airports, especially for international travel in the whole country. The airport officials say that they are screening people, especially if they have recently traveled to some of these countries that the CDC has placed in warning territory. And that's, you know, if you travel to Italy, if you're coming back from Iran, if you come back from South Korea or China, they're asking people to self-isolate. And in those cases, which means basically just keep yourself away from everyone and everyone for 14 days. And there's lower level travel warnings, which is basically just take enhanced precautions for Japan and Hong Kong. And
self-isolate.
One thing to note is from South Florida, we don't have direct flights to any of these to China or Far East Asia. We do have flights to Italy. But as of yesterday, Delta and American Airlines have announced that they are temporarily suspending direct flights to Italy from all of the U.S.
Again, talking with WLRN's Danny Rivero, Governor Ron DeSantis will be holding a press conference again at 2 o'clock about the coronavirus in Florida. Danny's been speaking with us about that. And he also had the opportunity, and I want to flip things over now and talk a little bit of politics. He had the chance to speak with county supervisors of elections ahead of Florida's primaries. Again, that's coming up on March 17th. So, Danny, you've had the opportunity to talk with them. First of all, what did they say about the upcoming primary? I know everything's got to be in place, but I just want to get a sense of how confident they sound, considering that, again, well, you know, this is Florida and, well, you know, we always have that concern something's going to go wrong.
Right. So I talked to two supervisors of elections. Both of them are new. I talked to Peter Antonacci in Broward County, who took over from Brenda Snipes when she was suspended by Governor Rick Scott, former Governor Rick Scott. And then I also talked to the supervisor of elections in Palm Beach County, Wendy Sartori Link. They both told me that they feel very confident going in, that they are going to be running operations very smoothly. Some of them, they've instituted some reforms and some changes in terms of how they staff things and how they process, say, absentee ballots coming in. And they're very confident that they won't have any of these choke ups that we saw in the 2018.
Well, let's take a look at Palm Beach County as an example. So one of the challenges under the former supervisor of elections in the 2018 recount was the fact they had old machines. Has that been settled?
Has been addressed. At the time, Palm Beach County had the oldest machines in the entire state. And since Wendy Sartori Link came in, they've purchased all new machines that can run multiple races at the same time if they need to do any kind of recount. What happened last time, a lot of the machines were overheating because they had to run the same ballot multiple times to screen for multiple races. So that shouldn't be an issue if, fingers crossed, there's a recount at any point. We're hoping no recount for your sake and my sake and everyone else's sake.
Florida's that close. In Broward County, Antonacci says that they've had a couple of elections to get a little bit of a practice in. What did he say about that? What did they learn from those elections that they're ready for the upcoming primary?
So the supervisor of elections there, he said it's basically dry runs. You know, they've had small municipal elections, and then now it's the big one. And there is five municipal elections in Broward County on March 17. But he's instituted some reforms. He said just simple things like when you get mail-in ballots in the mail, just process them the same day. You know, he said what was happening in that office before he got in is that they were actually kind of just letting these things pile up. And then once it came time to count them, they were trying to count them all at the same time. He said they've actually come up with a system that you process everything the same day that it comes in. And that should minimize any later, you know, snafus with things piling up.
Did either of them say anything about the fact that there's always the chance of a recount because we're just the state is that tight. It's that close. And so there could be a race that gets really, really close. Did they say anything about, how confident they are if they have to go through that?
Well, I heard from both of them. I mean, you can't, they're not in a position to take a stance on this, right? But they both told me that they're very confident that they have the systems in place to be able to pull something like that off without these long delays that we saw in both counties and which drew nationwide attention during the 2018 election when we had a statewide recount, but these two counties were very problematic.
The other issue, of course, is cybersecurity. We've been hearing that there were at least two, districts that were hacked, during the 2016 election, but we don't know who they are. We can just only, guess. But what have they said about cybersecurity and what they've added to, again, just give the voters the security, that the feeling that, look, we've got this under control, we're going to be all right?
So every county in the state of Florida is now participating in the Department of Homeland Security's system. They have a new system which constantly monitors all of these supervisor of elections offices, their voter registration databases for intentions to hack them. They get a lot of intents, and they're just monitoring to make sure that nobody actually breaks in. And this is new. Florida didn't have this before. And there's other things that Florida supervisors of elections have done. There's new technologies that will check that databases in other states to make sure that nobody is registered, in the state of Florida and also in New Hampshire, say, or somewhere else. And also there's new technologies to make sure that someone doesn't just vote twice in the same election.
There's supposed to be a program basically that once you have voted, it then knows right away.
It will stamp it immediately and say, Luis Hernandez voted, 10:29 a.m., he cannot vote again.
The other thing, too, in Palm Beach County was that we found out before the switch of supervisors that there was a hack in 2018 or before that.
It was in 2016. In 2016. That is something that the supervisor there did disclose. It came to her attention much after the fact, and that was reportedly never reported to federal law enforcement. So even in this famous Mueller report, we learned that two counties were hacked in Florida. That actually doesn't include this one, because this one was never reported to the authorities. And the supervisor there has said that the FBI and Department of Homeland Security are now looking into that hack that happened in that office in 2016.
All right. Well, we are coming up on the March 17th primary elections, and we've been told everything is ready. So let's keep our fingers crossed on that. Again, Danny Rivero joining us today. Danny, such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Still to come, many people are frustrated with Miami-Dade's bus system. Could a new redesign make you want to ride it? It's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Miami-Dade County could soon be seeing major changes to its bus system. Last year, the county commissioned a $250,000 redesign of the bus system led by the nonprofit group Transit Alliance. That group has released its new plan. That's going to improve life for some commuters. It could make it harder for others, but we're going to find out about that. The City of Miami and Miami-Dade County Commission still have to approve it. Azar Shoglay is the director of Transit Alliance. He joins me now in studio. As it's always great to have you.
So great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start, before we hear what the plan is, let's start with this. Remind us of what the Better Bus Project is.
So the Better Bus Project is the first time in the country that a community is taking their bus system back into their own hands. We are redesigning the entire Miami-Dade County bus network, including the trolleys in the City of Miami and Miami Beach. This is a bus network that hasn't been redesigned in over 30 years, so we're designing a bus network for the Miami of today.
And in that 30 years of nothing changing, what were some of the bigger challenges that you saw? And this is not just, I mean, look, you were riding the system to figure this out. What did you see as the biggest problems?
Well, I rode the system today, like every day. The biggest problem that we have today is that only 5 bus routes in our entire county arrive every 15 minutes or less throughout the day. So most people are waiting 30 minutes, 45 minutes, 60 minutes. In general, this leads us to a system that very few people believe in. The reason that some of your listeners might hear the word bus and think, ah, I have nothing to do with that, is because we don't have a system that a lot of people find very useful to begin with.
And by the way, if you ride that system regularly, or maybe you've given up on it, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Share with us your thoughts on what you think needs to change or what you'd like to change. Or the better question, too, is this. What would get you to ride it more? Okay, let's talk about this new proposed plan. What is it? What did you come up with after all this time? What did you come up with?
So we've come up with a system that actually completely transforms the way that our bus system operates in Miami-Dade County. So today, 1 out of 10 of our county residents can walk 5 minutes outside their door and get to a bus line that arrives every 15 minutes throughout the day. Just 1 out of 10 residents. We can change that to 1 out of 4. 25% of our residents in this new plan have access to a bus route that's 5 minutes away from their house or less, that comes every 15 minutes throughout the day, 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., Monday through Friday and Saturday, which is absolutely transformative. On top of that, we're making better connections for people. We're giving people access to more useful things on transits, and we measure that. So, for example, we're giving the average resident in Miami-Dade County access to 33% more jobs on transit. We're giving the average resident 41,000 more jobs that they can reach on our transportation system than they can today. And these are just some of the things that can be really transformative when you redesign a bus system for the city we have today.
The interesting thing about this, too, is that you had a lot of public meetings. You got a lot of input from people on this.
Yes, absolutely. So we had 108 events, workshops, presentations. We reached 2,600 people, 4,400 responses across 2 surveys. This is the largest engagement effort that's ever happened for bus services in Miami-Dade County. So it's been incredible to meet and hear so many stories from so many people who really want a bus system to work for them.
And when you guys finished, you came up with two questions mm-hmm. for everybody. Do you want A or do you want B? What can we do? But remind us of what those two options were and which one you went with.
So we asked people, how much do you value frequency? How much do you value one of those bus lines that comes every 15 minutes throughout the day versus having a system where we have routes that are a bit spread out, that where routes don't arrive so often? So we showed the community these two ideas, these two maps.
But the second one covers more people.
Right. The second one covers more
Just
people.
Just not the frequency.
Exactly. So what we've ended up with is actually a hybrid model that really does the best of both. So we have a lot more frequent service, and we have very few impacts to what we call coverage, very few impacts to where people might have an inconvenient longer walk, for example.
How did you pull that off?
We pulled it off by, one, trying to make a bus network that was as responsive to what people asked us to do, and two, bringing together international expertise, our local staff, municipal staff, a lot of community input, a lot of advocates like us who actually ride the bus, to really try and design a bus network that makes sense for a lot of people.
Now, most of the people that you talk to, they're regular bus riders. Or did you find that you spoke with people? How many times did you speak with people who drive, but they don't want to? They'd like to take the bus, but they just don't believe in it.
Well, the people who drive, and if you're listening right now and you count yourselves as one of them, think about that feeling you get when you wake up in the morning, you turn your car on, and you feel like you can go anywhere in the world, right? But imagine that the gate to your driveway opened every 60 minutes. That's what our bus system is like, where we have so many routes that come every 30, 45, 60 minutes, where when you need to make a connection, you're waiting half an hour. We need to give the bus riders, but also anyone who wants to consider the bus system, that same feeling. And that same feeling comes from a bus that arrives very often throughout the day, and we don't have those. And we can give the people that.
What, you know, you still have to have the city and the county approve this, but what have you been hearing from them? And obviously, you know, Mayor Carlos Jimenez, he came to you at the beginning. He said, look, I'll give you $250,000. You got to match it.
Mm-hmm.
And you did very quickly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all right, then go out and make this plan. How many conversations have you had with him, you know, throughout? I'm wondering what he's saying about what you came up with.
We've had conversations with elected officials at Miami-Dade County, at the municipalities, the department staff, with Mayor Jimenez himself. And generally, I think what everyone coalesces around is this is the only comprehensive near-term improvement to public transit in our county that can happen next year, period. There's nothing else on the table. And how many times have you had people on this show who are promising things? There's going to be a flying car. There's going to be a water taxi. There's going to be a bridge. There's going to be a train line. And at the end of the day, I think I'm the only person who's sit in this chair for a while that says next year we can reform the way that we do public transit in Miami-Dade County. We don't need to raise taxes. We don't need to raise additional funds. All we need to do is have our elected officials agree to a plan that the community has created together. That's it.
Have you ever figured out why it took us so long to get to this place? Why we went decades without fixing the system?
Well, what's that phrase that crisis is the greatest creator of opportunity or something like that? Do you remember the phrase?
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, this opportunity came about because we've lost 33% of our bus ridership, because over the last 5 years, it's suddenly come to such a crisis for our community that we can't afford as a community to move forward, where we have 750 buses operating and we have 26 million less boardings over the past 5 years. We're never going to get to the point where we can expand rail and create dedicated bus lanes and all this sort of stuff if people are abandoning the system that we have.
But that's not just Miami, though. Right? Nationwide, don't we see a decrease?
Correct, but not in the cities that have actually redesigned their bus system, Houston being the best example. And actually, Miamians, I know we like to consider ourselves quite special, and here's another instance where we can. We have one of the steepest declines of all the metro areas nationwide. So yes, bus ridership is declining, but a 33% decrease, now that's something to talk home about.
I'm talking with Azar Choklay, the director of Transit Alliance. The organization has proposed a new bus transit system with less wait time as part of their Better Bus project. This is a project where the organization and the community input is helping to redesign our county's bus system. And again, I want to hear from you. If you ride the bus, you're thinking about riding the bus, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Share with us your thoughts. You know, what would make it better? What would get you to ride that bus? I think Asdid had a great, analogy there. You know, imagine if you're driving and you're waiting for the gate of your community to open up and it took 60 minutes. But, you know, again, what would get you to ride more? Share with us. Let us know. How does your system compare? Because at the beginning you said that this is unique in the nation. But I wonder, is there another system where the project that you now propose that we're waiting for approval, does it compare to anything else you've seen anywhere else, like Houston?
Houston is actually still the best example because it's a city that's quite similar to us in terms of the way that their city is organized in terms of land use, right? They're a bit spread out. And also they were undergoing the sort of the same crisis that we were. And they are one of the few cities in the country where their bus ridership has increased year after year, whereas you have most of the nation that's suffering right now. And we essentially can have a system like Houston's, where we're going from 5 bus routes that arrive every 15 minutes throughout the day. In this system, we'll have 15 county bus routes. We'll actually even have 10 trolleys. We'll have a system of 19 integrated routes that connect to each other and to Metrorail. So that future that people envision in where, man, I wish I could live here without a car, we can make that future possible for a lot of people just with the resources that we have.
Now, the changes, though, there are going to be some people who it will be a little bit more inconvenient, though, right?
Right.
Not everybody's going to be happy with this.
Right. First of all,
okay,
change. No one likes change, especially after 30 years, right? 30 years of having a bus system that people have frankly just gotten used to. That's quite a bit of change. Now, there is an impact, and that impact is 3%. I'll explain what that 3% is. 3% of residents, now that's residents, not transit riders necessarily, just residents, 3% will have, who have a walk of 10 minutes today, will have a longer walk tomorrow. Now, this is generally in places where you have people who have households that have three cars, you have places where you don't have a lot of bus ridership to begin with. The problem is right now we have a lot of routes that are completely underinvested in. We have routes that carry 30, 40, 50 passengers a day. We have routes that carry two boardings an hour. And at the end of the day, for anyone who's concerned about the usefulness of their tax dollars, would you rather invest that in a route that carries thousands of people or very few? And that's what a redesign does for a lot of people.
So this is how we're going to increase frequency. It's not buying more buses and hiring more people necessarily. We're just moving from those places where the ridership is low. We're putting it into the better spots.
Yes, but bigger than that, we are actually integrating the City of Miami trolley system for the first time. So right now we have bus routes that are a ball of spaghetti that all kind of run on top of each other. And even though bowls of spaghetti are fantastic, I'm sure that's not what people want out of their bus system. So we're making a system that's fully integrated for the first time, where actually we can make far better use of our resources. And that's the main benefit that we're seeing, is not necessarily because we're reallocating service from one area to the other, which is what was happening with one of our concepts before. What we're seeing is a finally an efficient system that actually makes sense for people to use, and not a completely politically gerrymandered route system that doesn't make sense for anymore.
So again, the trolleys, you know, they're not going to be overlapping. How, again, just so we understand, how are you integrating or moving the trolleys?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how does that work?
It's very simple. If you have a trolley and a bus running on the same street, providing the same service, if you're a City of Miami resident, for example, you are paying taxes to the city and to the county, it would probably be a good idea that both of those buses don't do the same thing. How about we decide, sounds very simple, and frankly it is. How about we decide, hey county, you provide this regional service on Biscayne Boulevard, for example. Hey city, you provide this local service on Northwest 2nd Avenue. It's as simple as that. When you have buses run on the same street doing the same things, what you're doing is depriving a lot of other streets from having frequent service.
It's not just changing for the riders, but I don't know how the machine works, you know, when you're talking about public transit in, you know, in those offices. Is there going to be a big change for the employees that you have to, you know, go in and do a system-wide change, or will this be a smooth transition for them as well?
Everyone needs to be on board with this, but we're still a little far away from that moment of implementation. Where we are right now is we have a draft network, and we need the community's feedback on where to go with it. So if you haven't been to the website already, www.betterbus.miami, we have workshops coming up in North Miami, Miami Beach, Little Haiti, Little Havana, Alapara, Shenandoah. That's all this week, but we have workshops all throughout March. You can also text us at 305-912-9028. And no, this is not a pledge drive, so you can just send a text message to... That number again is 305-912-9028 to find out more about the system. Because before we get to the point where we can implement this, there's two things that are really important. One, we need to hear from people and look at the draft plan. Tell us what you think. Tell us what you'd like to improve. And two, your elected officials need to hear from you. They don't think most of the time that bus service is as important as it is to most of the people in our community.
Whenever I have politicians in here, we talk about the issue of that decline ridership, mm-hmm. and it's always the debate over, well, what would improve that? You know, if improving the system would, you know, get more riders, or are you only going to improve it if there's more riders? You know, so, I mean, what do you think's going to, do you think this is going to solve that once and for all?
Here's the beautiful thing about our bus system right now, and something that policymakers miss sometimes, is that we do have a lot of successful routes in Miami-Dade County. We do have routes that carry 10, 11, 12,000 daily riders. And it's a formula that's very easy to replicate. It's a formula of a straight, reliable route that arrives frequently throughout the day. And we are depriving most of our community from having that same experience. But in this plan, for example, we're sending 15-minute service down to Florida City. We're sending 15-minute service to FIU for the first time. We're sending 15-minute service to Miami Gardens. 15-minute service along Northwest 7th Avenue, Northwest 27th Avenue. 15-minute service outside the door of this radio station on 20th Street. We're creating a system where countywide we give people access to the same sort of thing that places like Miami Beach have had access to for a long time, which is a bus that comes throughout the day every 15 minutes.
So we got it. We got someone who called in. Peter from Miami has called in. He's got a question for you. So let's go ahead and get him in and see what he has to say. Peter, thank you so much. We appreciate it. What's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind is it's great the positivity of, you know, creating a new bus route, getting more ridership, and getting people out of their cars to actually use a service that would benefit a lot of people to get to work and just to move around and just ease up traffic flow. One of the biggest comments that I have is basically the buses that we have. Why are they so archaic? They're so noisy. They're so polluting of the air. And then we have a crossover of community buses and shuttles. You know, like Miami Beach has a shuttle bus that goes around there. North Miami has another shuttle bus. Aventura, they all have buses, but all of them, none of them are environmentally friendly. So why is there not a system that can, you know, okay, we're going to introduce new bus routes, we're going to get the ridership up, but why not have, you know, as an international city who where we bring people in from all over the world, where those cities, especially in Europe and also in South America, that they would have a bus system that's environmentally friendly and clean.
I've heard this. I've heard this, Peter. Our buses, they seem dirty on the inside and the outside, you know, and what they're doing. Peter, thank you so much for bringing that up. Okay, as you've been nodding your head as he was talking about that. What would you say to him?
This redesign is such a great opportunity because actually we're replacing our entire bus fleet, and already over 300, I think, have been replaced, and that just continues to go up. So on many routes, you will ride on a bus that was purchased in 2019 or 2020. Which is actually fantastic. And the new buses are great. They are compressed natural gas buses, which isn't as good as an electric bus. But what we need to realize within a system that's in crisis is that a bus that is empty, especially a CNG or a diesel bus, actually is very, very bad for us, right? So when we have a bus that is only carrying 6 to 7 people, and all those people might as well just be in cars, the crisis we need to address is not only moving towards an electric future, but also making sure that the emissions we're putting out into the air right now, that they actually are doing something for our community. And right now, they might not be.
How confident are you that city and county officials are on board with this? They're going to approve this plan. This goes forward.
It does not depend on me. And when I say that, it depends on every single person listening right now. If you've been frustrated for the last few years, many years, about how this needle hasn't moved, you need to join us to advocate for that. So that's www.betterbus.miami, transitalliance.miami. This is a community movement. This is not just me in a chair talking about a new bus system. This is hundreds of thousands of people who've gotten together to design something that they believe in, and it will not go through unless we follow through and deliver on it together.
And he is a man who does ride the buses, so he does know them. Again, Azar Shoghlaei, Director of Transit Alliance. As always, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thanks so much, Lewis.
All right. Still to come, we're going to hear the story of a Florida pilot who nearly died flying over Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's coming up next.
Tus verdes ojos con la luz del amor a tú y tu sonrisa reía más que el mar.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Florida played a critical role in strategy and military operations during World War II and the Cold War. But a number of the stories, particularly of soldiers who lost their lives in combat, haven't been given due attention. Historian Michael Tagayas is the co-author of a new book, Above and Beyond, JFK and America's Most Dangerous Spy Mission, which tells a lot of these stories. He has 3 events in the Keys this week, 1 in Isla Mirada on Wednesday, then 2 in Key West on Thursday and Friday, and you can learn more details about those on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Mr. Tagayas, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
So what role did Florida military bases, particularly in Orlando and Key West, play during the Cuban Missile Crisis and throughout the Cold War?
Well, Florida was really the epicenter for the military buildup for a potential invasion of Cuba or a potential bombing of the missile sites. But in particular, as you mentioned, up in Orlando at McCoy Airfield were 10 U-2 aircraft, which are the spy planes back in 1962 that could fly 13 miles above the earth so that Soviet MiGs could not reach them. And they were the ones who discovered the nuclear missiles in Cuba. and set this 13-day crisis in motion.
Let's talk about some of these stories. And I want to start with two gentlemen, Jerry McCloyle and Major Rudy Anderson. Tell me, who were these gentlemen?
Both were elite pilots. Only the very best pilots were selected by the CIA to learn how to operate these U-2s. And after they went through the training program, not many did make it, but they did. And they went back into the Air Force. And both were selected to do these overflights over Cuba once the first photos of the missiles reached President Kennedy's desk. And each put their lives on the line during their flights, and one lost his life and one came narrowly close to losing his.
Did the training happen down here, by the way? Did they get their training in Florida?
No, most of their training was Texas and California, really remote locations out in the desert. And the reason they were relocated to Florida was proximity to Cuba, particularly because we needed good weather forecasts before we launched to get these photos.
So Jerry McCloyle, let's talk about his mission over Cuban airspace. Why was he sent over?
Well, he was sent on a run to get four targets, and that's targets, not bombing targets, but with your cameras. And he was over the fourth target, which was near Guantanamo Bay, a little town of Banyes, Cuba, that for some reason, without authorization from Khrushchev back in Moscow, the Russians sent up two surface-to-air missiles at Jerry. And when I interviewed Jerry, he said, I was just banking the plane after getting the last photos, heading towards home, when in my rearview mirror, I saw the contrails coming up, and I stopped him right there, and I said, rearview mirror in a sophisticated aircraft? And he said, oh, yeah, just like your car. And I said, what did you do? And he said, I did what I'm trained to do, and that was bank the aircraft, get pictures of these missiles. He said, I knew they were behind me quite a ways, about a quarter mile behind. So he photographed the starbursts. And then I said, what next? And he said, I got the hell out of there. They were trying to kill me. And he lands in McCoy. And of course, the CIA and the Air Force debrief him. He tells the other pilots, and this is well into the crisis. This was on day number 10. He tells the other pilots, they're now firing at us. And then the strangest part happened the next morning. And I describe this in the opening chapter of Above and Beyond to kind of hook the reader. The next morning, he's walking to his aircraft, and he hears somebody go, McElmoyle. And he turns around, and it's a three-star general who he's never met before. And the general goes, we got your film in Washington, D.C. I just flew down. There was nothing on it. And Jerry goes, sir, I'm positive I got the contrails on the starbursts. And the general goes, not only was there nothing on your film, we destroyed your intelligence report. And Jerry again goes, sir, I'm positive. And finally, the general goes, do you understand what I'm telling you? In other words, zip it up. We think our theory is the military or someone close to President Kennedy did not want the president to know because they were worried he might shut down the U-2 overflights that were getting valuable military information.
And what did Jerry say about the fact that they were telling him to just shut up and don't say anything and the fact that they destroyed his evidence?
He was not too happy about that, but what could he say to a three-star general? But the irony of it all is he had quite a career in the Air Force and became a brigadier general. And years later, he was in the White House actually teaching Ronald Reagan the nuclear codes on the nuclear briefcase, the football, they call it. And the CIA was there, and they said, Mr. McElmoyle, anything we can do for you in the future? And he said, yes. Can you find the photo interpreter who looked at my film from October of 1962? And he said, a week later, that gentleman called him, and he said, oh, yeah, it was on your film, but we were ordered to destroy it.
Oh my goodness. Wow. It took all those years for him to finally get, I guess, closure on it.
Exactly.
So, you know, I wanted to know, how were you first introduced to Jerry?
Well, we learned that one of the pilots was not as fortunate as Jerry, and the co-author and I said, what a story. You know, I thought I was a history buff who knew about the Cuban Missile Crisis, but I didn't know that Major Rudy Anderson was killed. And I found Jerry by finding who were these 10 pilots who flew over Cuba. And Jerry's alive and well, living in Venice, Florida, just turned 90 years old. But I'd been interviewing him over the last 8 or 9 years, and he was a wonderful source and bright as could be.
Yeah, let's talk about Major Rudy Anderson. He was sent up on this follow-up mission over Cuba. Why?
We were probably one day away from airstrikes because the blockade was working, but only partially. But more importantly, the Russians were not removing the nuclear missiles as we demanded. So it looked like we would have to do airstrikes. And so these final runs were important for a potential D-Day invasion or the airstrikes. And Rudy Anderson actually volunteered for the flight. He was kind of a pacifist, even though he was in the Air Force and was in the Korean War. He did not want to kill anybody, but he did want to be known as the best reconnaissance pilot. And two Russian generals on the ground who did not have authorization to fire at him, they tried to get approval. The supreme commander of Russian forces in Cuba was deathly ill at the time. They could not reach him. So they decided that gives us the authority, and they gave the instructions to the surface-to-air missile site in Banyes, destroy target number 33.
And they shot him down.
Shot him down. It's amazing. You know, when I show the slides, I do show a slide of his aircraft on the ground, and I would have thought it'd be in pieces no bigger than my hand, coming from 13 miles up and being hit by a SAM. But apparently it was just one or two pieces of shrapnel that wounded the aircraft. And as Jerry described, if a U-2 is wounded, it comes down like a leaf fluttering from a tree.
Yeah,
lose one wing and then the other. And so the aircraft was pretty much intact, but Major Anderson was found in the cockpit dead.
Briefly, why do you think his story didn't get the kind of attention that Gary Power, who was another U-2 pilot who was shot down over Russia, he became an international story.
It's a great question. And, you know, it wasn't totally covered up. I looked at some old newspapers from 1962, and some of them did have one very brief paragraph that Rudy Anderson had been shot down. But I think the bigger case was Gary Power survived, and the Russians paraded him around, put him through a trial. So it was this ongoing attention, whereas Major Rudy Anderson was overshadowed by the subsequent agreement between Kennedy and Khrushchev, because we were on the brink of nuclear war. And that's what I'll be talking about, these four lesser-known incidents that put us a whisker away from nuclear war.
I'm talking with author Michael Tagayas via Skype. The author and historian is giving three talks in the Keys this week about Florida's involvement during World War II and the Cold War. Now, we have a list of the events on our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, so there's another story, this one about World War II, and it's specifically on Key West, and it's about a commander, Harro Schacht. I hope I'm saying that name right.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about who this guy is. What is this story?
Well, there were the two first U-boats that entered the Gulf of Mexico caught the U.S. totally by surprise. We didn't think they had the fuel capacity to go that far from Europe, but they did. And in So Close to Home, that's the book I co-wrote, we had the good fortune to find the war diaries for both Harro Schacht on U-507 and Eric Vardaman, the commander of U-506. And so in the book, we tell the story of what happened to the people that they torpedoed, the ones who survived. We did find an 8-year-old boy who survived a freighter going down and spent a lot of time with him. But Harro Schacht in particular was quite a colorful character. And when he rounded the Keys, he sank a ship, and at first the Navy didn't even believe the crew on the ship that sank that it was from a torpedo, because again, they didn't believe a U-boat could go that far. But then on the second ship that he sank, the survivors told quite a tale. They were in a life raft, and they said that the U-boat surfaced right near them. They thought they'd be strafed by a machine gun fire. And by the way, the Germans did not do that in World War II, whereas Imperial Japan did. And they said, out comes Harrow Schatz. And again, we confirmed this through his war diary. He's in a pair of shorts, he's tanned, and in perfect English, he goes, sorry about that. And then he has a U-boat maneuver closer to the life raft, and these poor survivors don't know what to think. And he hands them packs of cigarettes, matches, water, and even a cake from France. And he says, I hope you make it. I'm sorry I can't do more. All in perfect English.
He shoots, he sinks a ship, and yep. then the survivors, he basically apologizes to them. By the way, how often did U-boats, you know, conduct surveillance operations off our coast?
Not so much in terms of surveillance, but in terms of looking for ships. And, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because in Schatz's war diary, he says the navigation lights at the Tortugas were on as if in peacetime. And he couldn't believe it, that we were so slow to go to blackouts. And so he and Vertiman, in their diaries, they called it the happy hunting time, that they could sink ships with impunity. Schatz, you know, had such disdain for the Air Force that he was able to, as I said, go over and give these survivors some supplies. Normally, a U-boat would dive immediately and get the heck out of there, so a plane couldn't drop depth charges. And but he had no fear. He knew we were unprepared, and he was right. In the first 5 months of World War II, the U-boats sank approximately 200 ships in U.S. patrolled waters here along the U.S. coast and the Caribbean, and we sank all of one U-boat.
How often were there conflicts around the Florida Keys?
Oh, quite a bit. That was a good place for them to be looking for targets. It was, you know, coming by Miami. Another popular spot was just 20 miles off the mouth of the Mississippi River. And, you know, and so close to home, I write that Schatz even had the guts to go into the mouth of the river. And he wrote in his war diary, I can't go deep here, but good cover, because the river is kind of a yellow cover. So I'm lying on the bottom waiting for the next oil tanker.
And what about, that was during World War II. What about the Cold War? How often did we see, conflicts between the U.S. and USSR, you know, right there, you know, next to our shores?
You know, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, we set up the quarantine line about 500 miles off of Cuba. So not as close in terms of those conflicts, but very close in terms of the air cover that was going on, because in Air Station Boca Chica, we had Navy Crusaders, and these are supersonic jets that, after the U-2s got the initial photos, President Kennedy authorized Crusaders to do these low-level flights over Cuba. And sometimes they'd come screaming in at 500 miles per hour, right at treetop level. They would take small arms fire from the Cubans, but they'd come away with incredibly clear photos, which really surprised me that the technology in 1962 was that good, that, you know, flying at 500 miles per hour, you could actually see the nuclear missiles, see the Soviet trucks, and even see people right on the ground.
Well, it's you know, some of that amazing history, you know, from World War II and again from the Cold War, right here, right off our shores, right here in South Florida. Really fascinating stuff. Michael Tagayas, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and again, Mr. Tagayas, author and historian, he's giving three talks in the Keys this week. And again, we've got a list of those events on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Check them out. Well, that's our program for this Monday, March 2nd. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, in the Redlands, there is a migrant shelter of predominantly Guatemalan children. Miami-Dade County Schools is working to provide students proper education, spearheaded by Superintendent Alberto Carvalho. We're going to speak with the Miami Herald's Monique Madden about this story. Plus, have you heard of the python hunting program in the Florida Everglades? Well, a reporter spent months following a python hunter who was paid minimum wage to hunt the snakes at night. We're going to get a little inside story there. Finally, Ellen Zwillick is a Pulitzer Prize winning composer and a member of the Florida Music Hall of Fame. The Miami native will be in Fort Lauderdale, Miami, and Key West later this week. Now, don't forget, coming up here at 2 o'clock, Governor Ron DeSantis is holding a press conference at the Health Department office in Miami about COVID-19. There are two confirmed cases of the virus in Florida. We're going to keep you updated on that story. WLRN, by the way, is live streaming the announcement. Tune into WLRN's Facebook page to watch the press conference live. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening, as always, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. Dijo Martí, ¿de dónde crece la palma? Y antes de morir me quiero cantar mis versos del alma.